I have to grab me one of those. Do you guys have a timeline for, I know we're doing kind of a public beta test right now. Do you have a timeline for when this game would be available? And also, would it be available just on a 7800 cartridge, or would it be that plus emulation or anything in that realm?
Yeah, I think the idea is cartridge for sure. On the website, I imagine, I'm pretty sure there's going to be a ROM that you can play on a 7800 emulator.
Mm-hmm.
We would love to get it on Steam.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we can, but I know there is other 7800 games on Steam, so we haven't really looked into that, but I'd love that for accessibility. And then as far as like merch and posters and t-shirts, because Tom and I both work in animation professionally, we just love the art form. You know, anytime I could get posters made and t-shirts, I love that stuff. That's just side
way.
Passion, you know.
I got toques made this year. It was fun. Good times.
Yeah, it makes you feel visceral, right?
Yeah. It takes it from video games are interesting. I was talking with someone with the Canadian Video Game Museum about how so much of the experience of gaming and the connection is attached to that physical side of things, and I think a cartridge is one of the greatest ways to do that, because that's really where home video game and consoles started and exploded from.
Absolutely. I think people create new memories and excitement in the actual adventure of playing a video game, and you end up wanting a tactile connection to that thing. You don't need to be playing it all the time, but you want to be remembering it. T-shirt, poster, cartridge that you can pick up, box art, manual that you can flip through. It's a real adventure. And to your question earlier about releases, presently we've got about 50% of the game actually programmed and built out. But we are hoping to have the entire game finished by the end of the year, end of 2026, and potentially having the first batch of cartridges available for purchase on Atari Age sometime in early 2027.
Amazing.
With potential for those downloadable ROMs somewhere in the same area or closely following.
Wonderful. And where can people find your stuff on the internet, social media, anything like that?
We have some of the early demos available that can be downloaded and played from the forums on Atari Age. Brent, call me out. Like, your Instagram probably is a good place to find connections to.
Yeah,
like,
or websites, or just places where Radioland can go to find your guys' stuff.
Yeah, I have some stuff on my personal Instagram. We are bad with promotion, but we should get a designated...
I understand that. make the account.
Yeah, I do want to get a designated like Instagram or a YouTube page. We don't have that yet. We're sort of just piggybacking off our personal accounts, but right now we have like a support page, you know, like with some game info on it, which I could link to you guys.
Absolutely,
at Vancouver.
Yes. Yep.
But that's all we have right now. Yeah,
sweet.
Because we're bad at that.
Amazing stuff. Thank you guys so much. Everyone, when it's out, go check out Kinetescape, or if you find yourself at the Retro Gaming Expo, which Radioland might, but enjoy some 7800 glory. Thank you guys very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
We are in the later afternoon of the Vancouver Retro Gaming Expo, and not just classic video games, but brand new video games here. So for Radioland, can you tell me your name and the project that you've been developing?
Hi, I'm Max. I'm the developer of Astrolander. It's a modern take on retro platformers like Mario, Donkey Kong, Crash Bandicoot, those sort of games.
So I saw you've got the copy here running on the PS5. And I played it. I actually had the honor of being the first one in the morning to play, because we are neighbors here at the Retro Gaming Expo. And it has classic platformer vibes to it, in the sense of it will not give you... it will not just give the game to you. You need to work at it, you need to figure it out, and you need to use the gamer sense to be able to understand things. And after trying a couple times, I was given the fact that I can shoot the crabs with the disc. I can explode them. So I was trying to hop over them, and you're like, you can shoot them. And I'm like, oh, I can? Oh, this makes it so good. And I was just about to get to, I think, the second or third checkpoint kind of thing, up at the top of the bridge on the rock structure. Very good. Can you talk a little bit about kind of some of the game engine, some of your development process. How long has the project been under development?
Sure. It's been in development for PC, PS5 for about 3 years. Prior to that, I was just doing a simple PC version. Much simpler graphics, though. I really wanted to push it when I brought it to the PS5. I'm sure you saw how it took advantage of the DualSense, the various different controller features, and a wide different range of mechanics you'll encounter along the way. So as you mentioned, there are the crabs. In another level, you're facing off against the Kodama and Kodama, which are the golems and furry creatures, and there'll be dragons along the way that you have to defeat. And use various different abilities. So trying to incorporate different elements.
Wonderful.
The game is built in Unity. I'm using HDRP, which is their higher-end render pipeline. So you can see the visual quality is trying to really push it. But taking retro elements, so you'll see the MVPs, which are the CRT kind of combination robots, and small elements of retro-inspired, like the memory cards.
And the discs, absolutely. Giving that nod to physical media. Unity, a very powerful engine, and we were talking a little bit off mic about some of the audio engines, and we connected over FMod. Can you talk about your experience of using FMod as an audio engine?
Well, I really liked it because it allowed me to push the spatial 3D aspect of it. So it's a little bit hard to hear because it's a retro gaming expo,
for
it's
sure.
loud, but you can hear as you move along the various different surfaces. You'll be able to hear like if the creatures are rolling by or the beach balls are rolling by, you can hear them spatially move around. On the DualSense, there's a speaker on the controller, so certain elements are mixed between the TV and then near you with the controller, trying to push the audio side of things, not just the visual side.
The visuals look excellent. It really has taken that platformer into the modern age. And I appreciate the fact that it's got the tropical vibe to it. I'm a big fan of tropical games. Final Fantasy X at Passaic Island always has a special place in my heart. Kingdom Hearts opening.
Well, for me, it was Sonic Adventure.
Oh, yeah. Let's go.
The opening there.
One of the greatest soundtracks. Sonic music is fantastic. Did you do the music yourself?
No, I actually had it's custom composed for the game.
Nice.
My father actually handles that part of it.
Okay, cool.
And he makes it really, it's sort of a blend of sci-fi techno, but some hosts in the case of the tropical level, trying to push the beachy theme a little bit, but a wide different range depending on the level you're in. Kyoto is sort of Japanese inspired, so they'll have like temples you'll pass through and lanterns, so it takes a bit of like a more orchestral theme, but bit of like a more Japanese-inspired instruments.
Awesome. Do you have plans for, is this going to be a digital-only game, or do you have plans for a physical release at all?
Digital for now.
Okay.
But it is something I would love to do.
Yes.
Obviously, for modern consoles, it's harder. You have a certain order.
Absolutely.
But it's something I would love to do. I'm a huge fan of physical media. I always buy physical, so I would love to support that.
This exposition is like chock full of all of our classic games on there. What has surprised you most about the development project?
I think mainly the time it's spent on working on everything, really trying to push the quality. It takes a long time. I didn't want to cut back. I know some other games, it's easy to just say, oh, I'll just do this. But I really want to push it. And I realize that does take a lot longer, but I think the results speak for themselves.
Absolutely. There's it gives you an edge over just someone making a game. You're actually creating something that's a statement piece, not only for your history as a developer, but for video games.
I think our video games are a form of art.
Absolutely.
So it's important to put your own heart and soul into the project and truly reflect what you can do.
Where can people find more information about the project, our social media or website, anything like that?
There's LostCartridgeCreations.com is the website, and you can wishlist the game right now on Steam and PS5 with the demo coming later this year.
Beautiful. Once again, thank you so much. Appreciate it. We'll be looking forward to playing this one soon.
Thank you.
We are nearing the end of the Vancouver Retro Gaming Expo, but we must give a shout out to our good friend from Winnipeg with a brand new game available to play right here at the Retro Gaming Expo for Radioland. Can you tell us your name and a little bit about your project?
Yeah, so my name is Paul, and I'm representing Grafar Games, and my project is called Captain Awesome Adventures in Space. It's a retro-inspired platformer. The main mechanic is flipping gravity and fast-paced action. Difficulty level is there, better or worse, and it's a challenge, but it's good fun, and it's engaging. So,
now, with your involvement of the project, were you involved with coding or playtesting or art style?
So I'm doing just about everything by myself. I did have a third party generate the sprites for the main character and the enemies that I currently have. But everything else, I've done the music, the coding. It's a solo project, and I'm enjoying it so far, so it's been great.
What sort of game engines or programs are you using to build the game?
So I'm developing it in GameMaker Studio 2. I've been using GameMaker Studio 2 for a number of years. It's in my wheelhouse. I'm very comfortable with it. It's great for beginners and advanced users, so I've got nothing but good things to say about it. And so far it's been great. So.
How has the process of making music and sound effects been for you? And as someone who does a lot of sound design, I always, after having done courses in that, I now appreciate it even more.
Yeah, it's, you know, I do have a background in music in the sense that I took piano for a number of years through the Royal Conservatory of Music, so I got up to grade 8. So just a long way of saying that I'm not a beginner as far as music goes, but I haven't been designing my own music yet. It is a time-consuming process, and it's just a matter of focus. So things like art style, music, I've been doing things like going on itch.io. I've dipped my toe into using AI for the sound, and I have mixed results, if I'm being perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. So I'm not entirely convinced that that's the route I'm going to go at the end of the day. But so far, it's allowed me to develop my demo. So for the time being, that's where I'm at. But I'm already strongly considering outsourcing for music and sound effects.
Is this the first time that the game has been available for a public play? I know this. You mentioned this is your first time kind of exhibiting out here at the Retro Gaming Expo in Vancouver.
Yeah, I have made a number of YouTube videos since my demo's been out. My demo's been out on Steam for just over a month, but I haven't marketed it particularly strongly. I have been putting my focus into the expo today. That's where my mind has been at. So today is really kind of my coming out party in terms of exposing it to the general public and, more importantly, getting direct real-time feedback, which has been valuable. And the people here have been fantastic. So it's been a great experience. And, it's I have nothing but great things to say about my first time here at the expo. So.
Your setup here has kind of a triple screen setup. I love it. I love the fold-out aspect of it. And you've got some controller play style. And is that kind of the route that you're going to go for? Would you offer like mouse and keyboard, or maybe talk a little bit also about what platforms you're building this for?
Yeah, so the game, it's really focused on controller use. I'm trying to recreate the experiences that I had in my childhood playing late 80s, early 90s arcade adventure style games. Games that you can kind of pick up and put down after 10, 15 minutes that don't necessarily take half an hour just to learn how to play. So something that's intuitive and also fun. You can use keyboard. I do have built-in keyboard functionality. You can remap your buttons as you wish, or your keys as you wish. But I do have a controller-based experience in mind for this project. So,
how long has this project been in development?
I started in December last year, December 2025. So that's when I made a commitment to myself to not just get it going, but to get it finished. It's easy to get things started. It's a lot harder to follow through, as any artist will tell you. But it's been since December, and it's not a linear progression. Again, just like anything else, sometimes you have your better weeks where you're putting more hours than others, and that's okay. That's part of the fun and the adventure, and I'm loving the process. I'm really enjoying myself working on this. So it's been great.
Incredible stuff. For folks out in Radioland, where can they go online or in person to find out more information about the game?
So you can download my demo on Steam. It's, again, Captain Awesome Adventures in Space. The demo's there. I invite people to leave comments, reviews, good, bad, and ugly. I need the feedback. I want to hear from you. And you can send me an email at grafargames, GRAFARGAMES, at hotmail.com, and or at gmail.com as well. And, I'd love to hear from people. So.
We look forward to playing this one. I'm definitely going to download the demo when I get home. Thank you so much, Paul. Pleasure to meet you.
Connor, likewise. All the best. Thank you.
We're nearly to the end of the Retro Gaming Expo, but a visit to the Vancouver Retro Gaming Expo would not be complete without the Chilliwack Retro Computing Club. For Radioland, can you introduce yourself and what you do with the club?
Yeah, my name is Rob Carnegie. The club doesn't have a government per se, so I'm not the president of anything. I'm more just the guy that does all the work without any recognition. We are a club of enthusiasts. It doesn't cost anything to join. We have meetings in Vancouver. Well, actually, sorry, it's a sister club in Vancouver that meets regularly. They follow the same formula, no cost to join. It's just enthusiasts who like old computers getting together. Sometimes they're bringing an old computer to get help with it because it's not working. Sometimes they just got it working and they have to show someone. And sometimes they're just people who are kind of interested in computers and want to learn more. So it's from mostly computers from an age where computers weren't a commodity like they are now. So computers were not compatible with each other. They generally didn't run each other's programs or anything. And so we're preserving those devices, making them work, and, you know, helping educate people on computers that are a lot easier to understand than a modern computer. You know, even from my perspective, an iPhone is at least 50% magic, because everything's so tiny, I can't even point to it.
And flash memory as well.
yeah, exactly. These computers are ones where all the components in them are identifiable. Many of them you could make one from scratch today if you chose to. And in fact, some of us do that. I build computers from scratch with a soldering iron, not a screwdriver. And it's a really fun thing to do. It's doing something that I wish I could have been able to do 30 years ago when I first started being interested in computers. I spent my life learning about them, and I spent most of my career working in computing as well, so it's been something that I love to do whether I got paid or not. So
this exhibit features dozens of computers across all kinds of ranges from the 70s up until kind of the mid-2000s or so. Every single year I come up, we've got an Apple II in front of us right here. My dad actually worked at Apple way back in the day, in the Apple II and Lisa days, so yeah. You know, we're big Cupertino fans in our family. I also love the PC-98 stuff. I saw a bunch of the old vintage Apple gear, like kind of modern vintage. Radio Shack TRS-80s, the Commodore, the Tandy. We've got some blocky, oh gosh, what are those ones over there? Those are...
like IBM XT or AT compatibles.
Yeah, those guys. And it's really that whole thing about a lot of these were standalone systems. So every company had their own proprietary hardware and software running on them.
And generally, there wasn't much interconnectivity between them. Later on, they came up with computers that were dedicated to sharing information and a standard you could use a phone line to connect with. But that took time, you know, over time. In the early days of computing, when computers took up a whole room, the companies did not talk to each other. They didn't agree on anything, and nothing was compatible with anything else. So, you know, now it's hard to imagine it being like that. But back when computers like this were built, they didn't care about compatibility because their computer was so awesome, they knew you wanted to own one, you know. So...
kit building computers, that's kind of where some of these companies started, was building kit computers in their garage. Obviously Apple, the famous example. And then just behind me, I see some full, like, looks like server level architecture with rack equipment back there.
So that computer is actually classed as a mainframe computer.
Is that like an IBM mainframe?
It's not. That one's a Hewlett-Packard mainframe, but it was still a very respectable mainframe in its day. Mainframes make people think of giant computers, but often they weren't as giant as that. They generally weren't small, but I have two mainframe computers in my basement. I don't have a bunch of young guys to carry them here for me. They're usually not, the knowledge you need to run them is not knowledge that you get from using a modern computer. So you have to commit yourself to them. In my case, the mainframes I had were all computers that I worked with during my career before I retired.
For that mainframe behind us, what kind of storage devices does it run on?
Generally, the computers of that age would still have disks. Mainframe computers generally had some form of rotating disk media. So hard disks were fairly early into the game. And in fact, some of the computers that don't even have terminals still had hard disks on them. So they would typically also use tape as a storage media as well. Because the hard drives in those days usually weren't big enough to keep your database on. You just kept your library programs on them. and some of them weren't designed to store data. They were specifically for programs.
There's an awesome museum down in the Bay Area where I'm from called the CHM, the Computer History Museum. They have a fantastic mainframe exhibit with some old IBM stuff. I also have a deep appreciation for any computer or terminal, as they used to call it back in the day, with an amber screen. I love amber screen computers. Yeah. And I see you've got a couple examples of those around here as well, too.
Yeah, definitely. They came after the green screen. Eventually, people figured out that early on it was blue. Blue was very eye fatiguing. They switched to green. It was better, but still not great. Amber, I think, was the least pretty of all, but also the color that was the least kind of wearing on your eyes. The only thing that changed that eventually was Apple's influence with paper white, so a very, very white phosphor display. And then after that, it was all color. So you'll see devices like this. These are both green screens here. When this computer was first made, they didn't even make video monitors for computers yet. That's something that terminals had monitors built in, but to buy a monitor that wasn't part of a terminal wasn't really a thing, except for the displays that were used in TV stations, prisons, in security rooms, things like that. They'd have these little 9-inch. Those were the only monitors you could buy that you could connect to one of these. And that was my first monitor with this. It was one of those with a tiny little grayscale screen, like something out of that movie Brazil.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like, Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
Would that have been connected through like an RF connection? Or would it have been like a coaxial connection to the...
Generally, they were coaxial. They would be transmitting what's known as a composite signal, where the entire signal is all on one wire. So that was the most common method. There were other methods that were used in specialized equipment or on certain types of terminals, but that always meant more expensive as well. It was usually only done for specific reasons. It wasn't until the EGA display came out, because CGA had typically two connectors on. One of the two was the same round composite connector. Then EGA came along, and now round and composite are out the door. So.
And then the huge leap that was VGA with Video Graphics Array. And then would those earlier ones, CGA and EGA, would those have used like a serial port, an RS-32 style port? Or maybe probably an earlier standard of that port for...
Those are actually known as a Delta connector.
Okay.
People think of them as serial port because they were most commonly seen as connectors used in serial ports on computers, either a 9-pin or a 24-pin, I think, was the other, or 25-pin was the other alternative. That same connector is what the VGA, with its three rows of pins, that's still part of the same Delta connector type. So when people say, they'll say things like DB9 or DB25, the letter B represents the number of pins. So there is no such thing as a DB9 or DB25. The B designation means it's a 9-pin connector. D25 is the 25-pin connector. So, and there's many other variations of those that use the same Delta style jacket.
Like you said, the proprietary world was a massive jungle of different connectors and cables, and everybody had their own solution for throughput and speed and bandwidth and all those kind of things. One of the most impressive things I love about the Retro Computing Club is that it comes out in force every year, but it's also about preservation and revival. So people who are interested in this stuff, they can come to the meetings, and like you said, they've got older equipment that maybe they want to bring back to life, refurbish and reinstate it. I myself have a Macintosh Plus from back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And so we can, it's a huge leap forward. You can run stuff off of floppy drives. Yeah. So super good at that time. Where can people find more information about the Retro Computing Club?
Yeah, so the best place to look for us is on Facebook, because we have a pretty active community on there, and you just search for the Chilliwack Retro Computing Club on there, and you'll find our page. The Chilliwack Club, oddly, was the first one. Everyone says, why Chilliwack? Why not Vancouver? It's simply because myself and a few friends in Chilliwack founded it, and it was the only club in BC for a period of time. But now there's a Vancouver club. There's some other communities that are talking about organizing clubs. And we don't compete with each other. We get along with each other. And so we do things like specifically choose our dates so that you can go to all of them.
Amazing.
And I generally do go to all of them. And they each have their own particular characteristics. You know, the Chilliwack Club tends to be a lot more kind of hardware-oriented, or there's more people that are repairing, modifying hardware, building computers from scratch. You know, people have a little more storage space for things like that in the Fraser Valley than they do in Vancouver. But, you know, we welcome people no matter what their interest is. And even your observation about the range in age is people usually come into the hobby wanting to experience the computer they remember their dad bringing home back in the day. And for some people, that's a Commodore 64 from the mid-1980s. For other people, you know, it's the 486 that they had, or the Pentium 1, or whatever. You know, those experiences are really what we're there to preserve. And it doesn't matter to me too much what piece of hardware gives you that experience. And I've been taught by so many of the people who come to our meetings things that I did not know about computers, including ones that I'd used or owned before. You know, that's their interest, that's their study, and they know a lot about those. I started very early in the field in the late 1970s, and I experienced my career start out working on mainframe class computers. And so for me, personal computers were a hobby at that time. But it didn't surprise me much that they took over the world, because they're just so much better in experience.
It truly is a tour de force of computing history here. Everyone needs to come and see this exhibit. Go check out the meetings both in Chilliwack and Vancouver. And I always make it a point to spend some time here and realize that the computing of the past continues on with us into the future. So, Rob, thank you very much.
If I can just add, the Chilliwack Club meets on the third Thursday of every month, starting at 6:30 p.m. at a place in Chilliwack called Cowork Chilliwack. And it's this amazing technology center that you wouldn't expect to find in, you know, a farming town. It's you will not even imagine what's in this building. And they host us, they're a sponsor, so they allow us to do it without having to charge anything to participate, so you don't have to join, there's no form to fill out, you know, just come and enjoy, third Thursday of every month, all year round, we never miss, unless there's snow, but not to worry about that right now. And yeah, just come and join in. Doesn't matter when you arrive, and it goes from 6:30 until the last person leaves. So however late that is.
Amazing. Rob, thank you again. Chilliwack Retro Computing Club forever.
Thank you. Yeah, that's awesome.
A selection of interviews from the Vancouver Retro Gaming Expo, of which tonight we are doing a recap. So big thank you to, of course, Game Deals and the Vancouver Retro Gaming Expo for hosting Vancouver FM. But a special shout out to those six interviews. Roman from Chip Nomad. Go check out chipnomad.org. The Canadian Video Game Museum, cvgm.ca. Kinetiscape from Zapped Games. They are on atariage.com on the forums there. The brand new game Astrolander, which you can find on Steam. Grafar Games out of Winnipeg with Paul. Captain Awesome Adventures in Space. I believe you can download the demo now. And, of course, the Chilliwack Retro Computing Club. And you can find more information about them on their Facebook page. Wow. So good. And I do believe,
in about 30 seconds here, it's time for the news.